73. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. They found a what?
A finger,
Sig said. He kept his voice low, like he was sharing a secret.
Plus, someone's femur.
Out on the runway, the young staff sergeant with cropped black hair and a triangular nose made a face. He was barely 30, easily fooled.
That's what happens in a plane crash, Sig added,
his voice still quiet. With a glance over his shoulder, he checked for the fourth time that they were alone. It was almost 6 a.m., the sky starting to blink awake. Like any military base, Dover was up early. But not this early. As far as he could tell, there was still no one watching.
During search and recovery, we'll be finding portions of people for days.
The staff sergeant looked at the three metal transfer cases sitting there, each on its own industrial rolling cart. If they had been transporting fallen service members, the cases would be packed with ice and covered with American flags. These three were uncovered, looking like long silver coffins shining in the morning sun.
I don't know how you do it every day, the staff sergeant said. His name tag said Kiesel. But I appreciate that you do.
Then maybe you can help me get these on board, Sig asked, tugging on the metal cart and steering one of the metal transfer cases across the asphalt runway.
He didn't like hiding Nola like this,
but 40 minutes ago, as he rolled her out of the hearse and into the mortuary building, and then switched her from the casket into one of these metal shipping cases, he knew it was the only way to pull this off. 50 yards ahead, a mammoth C-17 transport plane was on the flight line, its back loading ramp wide open, awaiting its last few items. The four fans weren't spinning yet, but its engines were prepping, making a loud drilling sound.
Here, you need these, Kiesel said, reaching into his pocket and handing Sig what the army called hearing protection,
a $2 set of bright orange earplugs. As Sig put them in with one hand, he used his other to wrap his knuckles against the head of the metal case, right where he drilled the air holes. A single tap, loud enough that there was no missing it. Simple code. Almost on the plane. Sig knew Nola was too smart to tap back. Not until she was sure they were alone.
So you think there are more bodies in Alaska? Kiesel called out, grabbing the other two rolling carts and giving them a tug.
He was used to the job. As a loadmaster, he was in charge of the plane's cargo.
We'll certainly find out, Sig said, leading the way and checking over his shoulder for a fifth time.
He scanned every window in every nearby building. On the second floor of the mortuary, a light popped on. Dr. Sinclair in the ME's office was setting his morning tea on his desk. Even if Sinclair looked outside, there was nothing out of the ordinary, at least for Dover. 2 days ago, Kiesel and his crew flew the bodies here from Alaska. Today he'd be making the return trip, the plane restocked with empty transfer cases for when the next disaster hit. For mass fatalities or something like a plane crash, a mortician would also be sent to the crash site to help with recovery and cleanup. A detail Sig took full advantage of first thing this morning when he switched with a co-worker to be on this outbound flight. To keep anyone from finding out, he didn't even put it in the system. Stay out of sight. Don't let them know you're coming. The only question was, could he do the same for Nola? There was a metal cha-chink as the wheels of the rolling cart hit the base of the plane's ramp.
Here, let me help, Kiesel called out. The cases are light. We can just carry them on
I'm fine, Sig insisted, shoving the rolling cart and pushing it and the metal case up the ramp. The thick wheels on the cart were able to hold 600 pounds. This should be an easy climb, if the casket were empty. Sig stared down at the aluminum case. Even as it rolled, it barely rattled at all.
You okay? Kiesel called out.
Fine. Tweaked my back a few weeks ago, Sig said, faking a grin and taking a sixth scan of the building behind them.
There was another cha-chink as they reached the top of the ramp. Inside the plane, the cargo hold was pretty much bare. If a general was scheduled to be on board, they'd roll in a pallet with a fully functioning executive office, complete with desks, couches, and a fancy bathroom. If there were loads of passengers, they'd add a pallet filled with airline-type seats. Today, though,
At the back of the cargo hold were two large supply crates strapped into place. The rest of the open space was empty, except for three other metal transfer cases lined up side by side, their toes facing Zig in meticulous formation.
There should be straps.
I see 'em, Zig said, eyeing the black nylon straps that would hold the case in place. Inside the cargo hold, the humming of the engines echoed even louder. In one quick movement, Zig turned the push cart around, lowered it to the ground, and gave a tug to the handles on the aluminum transfer case. Six metal rollers sent the case sliding toward him. Momentum let it skid across the floor and roll into place so that the head of Zig's transfer case was perfectly in line with the foot of the case already on the plane. Outside the back of the plane, at the mortuary, another light went on in another window. The blinds were closed, but Zig knew that room. Colonel Sue. If she found out what Zig was up to. Don't think about it. Just keep moving. Get to takeoff, Zig told himself, quickly ratcheting and strapping Nola's case to the metal floor so it'd stay put during the ride. Next to him, Kiesel was doing the same, lost in his work. Seeing Kiesel distracted, Zig again gave a quick knock-knock to the metal case. Two taps this time. On the plane.
Need some assistance? Zig offered, turning his attention back to Kiesel, who was already working on the third case.
With a hard tug of the nylon straps, they ratcheted it in place and locked it to the floor. Outside the back of the plane, two more lights went on in the mortuary. Time to get this moving.
What else you need? Zig asked, purposefully stepping a bit too close into Kiesel's personal space.
Actually, I should get upstairs, Kiesel said, heading for the ladder that led up to the cockpit. Despite the mammoth size of the plane, the flight had a tiny crew. Pilot, co-pilot, and Kiesel, the loadmaster, who stopped at a large wall panel of knobs and switches. He pushed a button, and with a mechanical whir, the loading ramp slowly closed, swallowing the morning sun from outside. Zig's eyes were still on the mortuary, which seemed to shrink as the back door shut. The interior went dark. Fluorescent lights popped on.
10 minutes until takeoff, Kiesel said as the plane began to rumble. The first of four engines started to spin up to full speed.
Sorry I can't offer you a better seat, Kiesel added, pointing to the fold-down jump seats along the wall of the hull. Our pilot's a stickler, but once we hit 10,000 feet and level off, I'll get you up in the cockpit. As Kiesel disappeared upstairs, Zig pretended to sort through his own belongings, including the oversized army duffel he'd brought onto the plane earlier and strapped to the metal rings on the floor. Inside was Zig's winter coat, plenty of layers, plus his full mortician kit, including baggies, modeling clay, makeup, and of course, scalpels and tools. He also had a guidebook on their actual destination, Alaska's Wrangell St. Elias Park and Preserve, not far from where the original plane went down, and all of this started. Zig already knew the park was enormous, the largest national park in the entire country, but according to the guidebook, it was also one of the least explored, which begged the one question Zig still couldn't answer. What was the government really doing out in the Alaskan wilderness? From what Nola said, and what Zig learned at the magic shop, Houdini's specialty was moving money. More specifically, money that was used to pay off innocents when the government accidentally plowed through their lives. So was that what happened in Alaska? A disaster took place during Operation Blue Book. Or was Blue Book itself the disaster? Whatever the case, according to Nola, only one person had the answer. The person who was pulling the strings from the start. Horatio. Outside, the second engine churned to life, its fan now spinning. Wouldn't be long now. Sitting in the jump seat and pretending to flip through his guidebook, Zig opened to a page that featured the rare fauna of Alaska, including a tiny blue flower that was so poisonous it could kill a humpback whale. Upstairs, there was a loud metal clank, the cockpit door slamming shut. Kiesel was finally inside. Racing across the hull, Zig slid down on his knees, nearly slamming into the farthest transfer case on his left. He gave the metal top three quick taps with his knuckles, their final code. All clear. Zig waited for a response. Nothing. He tapped the case again. Three taps. All clear. Tap back that you understand. Still nothing.
Nola, can you hear me? Tap back if you hear me,
Zig whispered, his mouth up against the casket's air holes. Once again, nothing but silence. Zig's brain quickly calculating just how little air was inside. The air holes he drilled were big enough, weren't they?
74. Homestead, Florida. 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. He threw the letters at her head, the whole stack of them. It happened midway into one of Royal's rages, one that ignited when he blamed Nola for a flat tire caused by a broken bottle of scotch in their driveway. Never mind that the bottle was left there by Royal.
You should know to clean it up. That's your job, nigger, Royal screamed.
It had been barely a week since Royal lost the military granola bar deal. He was back to making IDs and fake paperwork for Mr. Wesley. Nola was down on her knees, garbage bag in hand as she picked up shards of glass from the driveway.
You know what this cost me? That was my spare. Whap!
She didn't even see where the letters came from. Royal reached into the car. Was he hiding them in the glove box? And next thing she knew, with Royal in mid-rant, his rage peaking, the full stack hit Nola in the back of the head. Ancient letters from Barb LaPointe scattering along the asphalt.
Don't you dare pick 'em up,
Royal roared, awkwardly trying to kick the letters down the driveway, most of them going nowhere. At the sight of it, Nola almost laughed. She didn't, though. Not after what he did last time he thought she laughed at him. Still, seeing the old letters, an odd relief ran over her. She knew he'd make her pay for finding the letters. At least the waiting was over.
You think you can go through my stuff? You think you can steal from me like that?
I didn't steal, Nola thought to herself.
Don't look at me like that. You got something to say?
Nola stared straight down, picking glass from the driveway, knowing better than to answer.
You know how much money you cost me? When those thieves, the LaPointes, when I took you in, that wasn't a party. I was trying my fucking best, but it cost money. Everything costs money. Class costs money. Don't I teach you that?
He shouted, working himself up to the next level of rage. A bonus level, where he was yelling so loud his voice went hoarse and his nostrils went wide. The grid of veins below his eyes was now showing. Nola knew what came next. Hoping to buy some time, she picked up the final shards from the driveway, a web of glass held together by the scotch label, and tossed it into the trash.
Let's go. Now!
Royal growled, yanking her by the back of her neck, shoving her toward the side of the house to the backyard. At the center of the yard, Royal unleashed a violent kick on the upside-down kiddie pool, sending it sliding across the green grass, wobbling like a 1950s flying saucer and revealing the hole that Nola had been digging since they first moved here.
Half hour, no stopping,
he said with a final shove, sending her crashing to her knees into the damp dirt.
No breaks either.
At the bottom of the hole was a shovel. A new one, actually, since Nola threw the old one away, pretending it was stolen. Royal borrowed this one from a neighbor, Nola knowing he'd never give it back.
What are you waiting for?
Royal added, even though she was already climbing into the hole, which was as long as a coffin. It was deep now, too, up to her thighs, and would have been even deeper if the frequent Florida rain didn't backfill at least half of it with each downpour. Royal didn't care.
When you dig yourself into a hole, you dig yourself out.
For the next half hour, Nola did just that. Shovelful by shovelful. She wasn't 8 anymore. She'd just turned 16. Each scoop of dirt was hard, but it wasn't impossible. Her hands had calloused long ago as muscle memory handled the rest. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. 20 minutes in, she'd barely slowed down. It's not that she wasn't tired. Beads of sweat high-dived from her nose. but over her shoulder she could feel Royal watching from the house. She wouldn't give him the satisfaction. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. 25 minutes in, the sky was getting dark and the moon was out. A half moon. Nola wouldn't look up at it. Ever since Royal gave her the moon as a present, she hated it. By the last few shovelfuls, sprinkles of dirt were scattered across the back of her neck, in her hair, on her arms. She was covered, but finally finished. She looked back at the house. Royal was gone. Tossing the shovel like a javelin into the ground, she actually felt good. In fact, as adrenaline flooded her brain, it made her wonder if, despite Royal's assholiness, he might actually be onto something. After so much digging, her anger was gone, or if not gone, at least muted. She remembered that, taking it with her always. Heading back to the house, she saw the kitchen lights were on. Royal had grabbed a soda. TV flickered from the living room. He was now medicating himself with sports highlights, waiting for her to make dinner. She took it as a good sign. He didn't like anything interfering with dinner. Indeed, as the back screen door snapped shut behind her, the one thought in Nola's brain was that maybe tonight might even be a quiet night. She couldn't have been more wrong. She stopped mid-step, seeing the shadow on the orange linoleum floor that was supposed to look like terracotta tile.
Dooch?
At the center of the kitchen, her skunk was lying there, flat on his side. His four legs were awkwardly extended like he was sleeping, but he always slept curled up in a ball.
Dooch?
Nola whispered, the dark feeling already tightening in her chest. The skunk didn't move.
Dooch? You okay?
She added, smacking her palms together in a single loud clap, hoping to startle him. Even before the sound hit, she knew the answer. The skunk didn't react to the sound. Didn't move. He just lay there, frozen on his side, with a weight Nola had never seen before but instantly recognized.
No, 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 no,
Nola pleaded, sliding to her knees, fresh dirt raining off her as she scooped the lifeless skunk into her arms. His body was stiff. The stiffness caught her off guard and she dropped him. He bounced awkwardly against the linoleum, his eyes still open, pupils wide and dilated. She didn't care. She scooped him up again, holding him to her chest, embracing him and knowing this lifeless thing in her arms. It wasn't her pet anymore. It was just a thing. And she hated herself for thinking that.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry,
she whispered, down on her knees, rocking back and forth, cradling Dooch's body. In the corner, his food bowl held a few crumbs. He'd just finished eating. Nola didn't cry. She kept that promise. There was a moment where she thought the tears would come, but it passed too fast, punctured by a far more powerful feeling, a swell of anger, of hatred, real hatred, that crept up from her belly, invading her on a molecular level. There was a noise on her left. She turned. Royal was standing there like he'd been there all along, arms crossed at his chest, soda in his hand, on the threshold of the kitchen.
My God, what happened?
He asked. The world went red. At just the sight of him, Nola could feel something hardening inside her, could feel something elemental rising.
Is Dooch okay?
He added. On most days, Nola's specialty was finding the hidden things, the lies we hide every day. But here, in this kitchen, as she cradled her dead pet in her arms, Royal wasn't hiding anything. It was right there on his face. He had a fire behind his eyes and an unmistakable grin.
Nola, I feel awful for you. Is there anything I can do?
She wanted to fight. Wanted to rush at him, wanted to lace her fingers around his throat and squeeze tight until her nails pierced his windpipe and his life was gone, and he was the one who was just a stiff, empty, lifeless thing. But she knew what would happen in a fight like that. Today was proof of it. She wasn't fighting a man. Royal was an animal.
God, just heartbreaking, right? Royal asked. The world isn't perfect. Why do folks think it is?
She didn't respond. Years from now, an army psychologist would make a note in Nola's file saying she suffered from RAD, reactive attachment disorder, which happens when a child can't form attachments because of early neglect. But tonight, silent Nola just sat there, down on her knees, cursing herself for thinking she could have anything good, and cursing herself even more for taking the pet near Royal in the first place. If she hadn't taken him home, he'd still be alive. Lesson learned. She'd never bring anything she loved near the house again.
75. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. Today.
Nola, we're on board. All clear,
Zig whisper hissed, leaning down to the casket's air holes. He pulled out his earplugs so he wouldn't miss her response. Outside, there was another loud whir. The third engine began its high-pitched whine. One more until full power.
Nola, you hear me?
Zig added, now louder, his mouth up against the air holes.
You okay?
Final check, Kiesel called out on the PA system. 2 minutes to takeoff.
Silent, Nola. That's her MO. Always silent, Zig told himself.
He thought again about the air holes. They had to be big enough. Right? Behind him, Zig heard a noise by the stairs. Kiesel was coming. Racing back toward the jump seat, Zig grabbed the Alaska guidebook, pretending to read.
Make sure to strap in, Kiesel shouted over the noise, hopping off the bottom step for his final inspection.
Zig fastened his safety belt, still studying Nola's metal case.
She's fine,
he insisted, reminding himself that there's enough air in a coffin for at least 4.5 hours of breathing. Kiesel made a quick loop through the hull, checking every light, every gauge, every switch, every cargo strap, plus the anchor line cable that ran down from the ceiling. Diagonally across from Zig, toward the back of the plane, he noticed the side door with the red and green lights above it. Emergency exit. Wide enough for a casket. Zig didn't even want to think about it. She's fine. There was a final loud whir as the fourth and final engine began to whine.
See you at 10,000 feet, Kiesel called out, closing the door and heading back upstairs.
The moment Zig was alone, he raced back to the case. Forget the stupid codes. He banged hard on the metal top.
Come on, Nola. Give me a response.
He put his ear to the case. Nothing.
Nola, if you're okay, say something,
he shouted directly into the air holes. Still nothing.
Could she have passed out?
Zig stuck his fingers into the air holes. All clear. Even if they weren't, there's enough air. Zig banged the case again, harder than ever.
Maybe being in a confined space. Maybe she did pass out. If she did, she'd still be okay. Unless,
Zig's brain was racing now. If she accidentally turned on her side. Zig shook his head, refusing to consider it. And then he replayed the familiar image that always leapt into his brain whenever he saw a news report about a child who drowned, or a little boy who was shot by a stray bullet, or a young girl who... Zig shut his eyes, but he couldn't stop seeing it. The red siren, spinning and blinding him. He was fighting through a crowd, pushing his way to those doors, to the open back doors of an ambulance. The doors seemed so far away, and then suddenly so close. Close enough to see. There, dangling from the gurney. A sagging arm. His chest turned to ice. Every parent knows their child. He knew it 10 minutes ago. But now, to see it again. To see it this close. That was his daughter's arm. Maggie's arm. Just from the color of it, the gray color. He knew all hope was gone. He was still elbowing through the crowd, fighting to get closer. No one fought against him, except at the end, when he reached the tall black paramedic who had no hope of stopping him. And then Zig was standing over the gurney, gasping for breath, like his lungs would never hold air again. No, 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 no. Even now, Zig could hear himself sobbing, praying, pleading with God that Zig could trade and be the dead one instead. Nola! Zig shouted, grabbing at the metal casket, undoing the nylon straps with one hand, the clasps along the side with the other. She needed air. Get her out! He flicked open the final three clasps at the foot of the case. Ka-clack, ka-clack, ka-clack. Gripping the lid of the metal case, he wedged his fingers into its seam. Zig's body swayed as the plane began moving, taxiing toward the runway. Still plenty of time to get her out. Get her help! With a yank, Zig lifted the lid and shoved it back, revealing books. Nothing but books. Confused, Zig looked over his shoulder, scanning the empty hall. He looked back at the books. There were dozens of them, fanned in a neat stack like tumbled dominoes. Textbooks with titles like Modern Military Uniforms and 20th Century Military Regalia. They were from the library. The tall bookshelf right next to where all the extra caskets and transfer cases were. Mother Trucker. That's where Zig took her. When he snuck Nola back into Dover, he backed the hearse into departures, moving Nola out of the casket and into the metal transfer cases that were stored there. When Zig went out to check on the plane, she must have... Again. She did it again. Zig slammed the lid shut, kicking himself for not seeing it coming, for not seeing the big move or the small one. He should have known all along. It's the one rule of Nola. Nola doesn't change. Vrrr! The plane rumbled and shook, picking up speed as it rolled toward the runway. Zig replayed their last few hours in the motel room last night, slowly fitting each piece in place. When Nola was clicking through Houdini's watch, she found new coordinates. From there, she knew Zig's weaknesses, his guilt and sentimentality. All she had to do was ask him to team up, make him think she wanted help. That's all it took. Nola didn't need Zig to get on the plane, or to go anywhere near Alaska. No. The only thing she wanted from Zig was to get her here. Into the one place where only he could bring her, directly into Dover. And for the third time, Zig walked right into it. The rumble of the engines was deafening now, but as the wheels left the ground and Zig was down on his knees fighting for balance, he didn't know what worried him more, that somehow the digital coordinates on the watch traced back to Dover, or that whoever Nola was now searching for, they'd been hiding here all along. 76. There he is, a female voice called out. Master Guns rolled his eyes at his boss's favorite line. There he is, she'd say, adding a thumbs up if she really wanted to sell it. Sure enough, as Colonel Sue stepped into his office, she gave him a big thumbs up with a double pump. Sue was a politician. If she was leading with charm, bad news was coming. Before she even turned the corner, Master Guns shot out of his seat, standing at attention behind his desk, both hands at his side. Really, Francis? Sue asked, clutching her cell phone. She was always clutching her cell phone. Have I ever been that formal? Master Guns stood there, straight as a pencil. He was a Marine. Customs and courtesies still meant something. Colonel Sue was Air Force. Didn't mind breaking. So typical. At ease, okay? That make you happy? Sue asked. Just showing respect, ma'am. Sue waved him off, like they were the oldest of friends. But Master Guns didn't need to be Dover's chief investigator to know they weren't. What can I help you with, ma'am? You weren't at yesterday's stand-up, Sue said, referring to her morning senior staff meeting. You also, considering all the bodies that arrived, didn't file a report for this morning's stand-up. Just making sure you're okay. Apologies, ma'am. No offense meant. I've just been busy with the Alaska investigation. I figured, she said, adding a smile to keep things light. She took a seat opposite his desk, glancing over at the framed antique American flag on the wall. 38? She asked, counting the stars on the flag. 1876, from when they added Colorado. My home state. Master Guns took a deep breath through his nose. Ma'am, if there's something you want to talk about, I got a call this morning about the plane crash in Alaska. Mind you, I've been getting calls all week, but this one came from the White House's chief of staff. That little bug. What's his name? Galen Gibbs. Galen Gibbs. He calls me every few hours looking for details. He calls me every few minutes. Sue laughed at that, her eyes no longer on the flag. So you can imagine my surprise when Gibbs called me at 5:30 this morning and asked me when the final autopsy report would be filed. Not just for the Librarian of Congress, but for the other victims on the plane. Clifford Eddy, Rose Mackenberg, Amadeo Vaca. He wanted all of them, said they weren't filed yet. So odd, right? Our medical examiners are usually meticulous about that. Those should have been filed immediately. But they weren't. Master Guns sat there silent, his hands gripped together on his desk in a little church and steeple. Then imagine my further surprise when I asked Dr. Sinclair about the reports. And he told me he gave them to you, Francis. That you personally asked for all the victims' reports yourself. Even the one for the Librarian of Congress. Ma'am, this is my investigation. I have every right to see those reports. Then see them after he files them. You can read them online like the rest of us. I appreciate that, ma'am. So I hope you also appreciate that the way things have been going here lately, I'd rather read from the original sources than trust what gets put online. What's that supposed to mean? It means I am absolutely tired of talking in euphemisms, ma'am. We both know what you're asking. When Nola Brown's body first arrived from Alaska, that body wasn't Ms. Brown. And Clifford Eddy, Rose Mackenberg, and Amadeo Vaca, that's not who they were either, were they? You knew that from the moment those fallen were packed in ice and sent here. Now Colonel Sue was the one gripping her hands together, strangling her cell phone. Also, ma'am, when it comes to an ongoing investigation, you know I can't talk about any of my findings. Sue went to say something, stopped herself, then started again. Francis, when people hear that this is my command, they assume I'm a serious person, that there's no humor in death. But if I've learned anything at Dover, it's that this place is filled with the absurd. Dead bodies fart. When you embalm someone, their penis engorges. Some things must be laughed at. But that accusing tone in your voice? There's nothing funny about it, Francis. You hearing me on this? If you've altered a word in those reports, you're breaking the law. So you don't have a problem with our medical examiner filing false reports. Was that your idea? Or were those just orders from someone higher up the chain of command? I told you, be careful with that tone, soldier. Not a soldier, a marine. Sue rolled her eyes. Francis, spare me the bluster. You should have never taken those reports before they were sent to my office. Me? You're the one now interfering with an active There was a loud ring. Master Guns's phone. He looked down at caller ID. He knew the number. So did Colonel Sue, who was glancing at it as well. 202-406 prefix. United States Secret Service. Why are they calling you? Sue asked. Master Guns didn't answer. Ring. Pick it up, Sue said. He still didn't touch it. Ring. Francis, pick that phone up now. That's an order. Ring. Sue's arm shot out like a cobra as she pounded the button for the speakerphone. This is Colonel Agatha Sue. Who's this?
Terry O'Hara, Secret Service, a strong, determined voice said through the speaker. I'm looking for Sergeant Steranko.
The sergeant can hear you just fine. I'm his supervisor. How can we help you, Agent O'Hara? O'Hara paused, but not for long.
Ma'am, I'm not sure if you're aware of the subject we've been tracking. We now believe that subject has breached security.
Breached it where? Sue asked.
On base, O'Hara replied. We've got a full mobilization headed your way. After you activate surveillance and heightened security, we recommend you lock it down until we locate the target.
What target?
Horatio, ma'am. We believe Horatio's now inside Dover.
From opposite sides of the desk, Colonel Sue and Master Guns looked up at each other, both of them confused. Simultaneously, they asked, "Who's Horatio?"
77. FBI Headquarters, Washington, D.C. Amy Wags was having one of those days. One of those years, actually, ever since she tweaked her back hurling down a zip line on that stupid singles cruise her sister Kim talked her into. At 38 years old, she should have known better than to listen to her sister or ride a zip line. All she had to show for it was a herniated disc, $4,500 in chiropractor bills, and a tall, adjustable-height desk that took the pressure off her spine but meant she was on her feet all day. It was barely 6 a.m., her favorite time of day when the office was quiet, when the sky was dark, the best time to think. So here Wags was, elbows on her adjustable-height desk, clicking through folder after folder, reading Dover report after Dover report, searching for the name Zig had told her this morning. Horatio. 3 days ago, when Zig first called her to trace Nola's fingerprints, Wags was doing a simple favor. But somewhere along the way, this became more than just a courtesy for a friend. From the start, this case reeked. She knew it. Covert missions happened all the time. To protect national security, the CIA would regularly mask the names of Dover victims so that agents and sources weren't revealed. But those cases had their own rhythm, their own pattern of governmental checks and clearances. Reports were written. Files were created. None of that could be found here. And neither could any trace of Horatio, Wags realized, running yet another search on Dover's intranet. Still nothing. For a few moments, Wags stood there, staring blankly at the only totem she kept on her desk, a Grateful Dead Dancing Bears soy candle from their reunion tour in Chicago a few years back. A present from her older sister. Growing up in rural Iowa, Wags' sister loved to color. Her brother used to love mazes. Wags, though, she loved connect the dots. Such a simple treat. From 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. Follow along and the bigger picture will emerge. It was no different today. To move a body in and out of Dover. Was that hard to pull off? Not really. Leaning back and doing that stupid stretch the chiropractor gave her, Wags could think of a dozen different ways. But the one pattern that kept repeating? In every move across the chessboard, wherever Zig went, someone was always there first. When Zig went to check on Nola's body and departures, someone had already arranged to take it. When Zig went to Nola's office, someone was already lying in wait. Wherever he moved, they always knew Zig was coming. Like someone tipped them off in advance. For the next hour, Wags ran the list of every Dover mortuary employee, checking it against the entrance records of every person who had gone in and out of Dover during the last few weeks. She checked flight manifests to see who landed there, then rechecked those same manifests to see who flew out. She even put in a request for phone records, specifically those of Colonel Sue and Master Guns, just to be safe. Then she ran all those names, cross-checking to see who had ties to Zig, to Alaska, to Nola's office at Fort Belvoir, to the Secret Service, even to the White House itself, and of course to that name, Horatio. Despite all the dots, no pattern emerged. That is, until Wags reached for the thick, padded envelope that had been sitting on the edge of her desk. There was no stamp in the corner. Hand-delivered, just like Wags asked. The bubble wrap popped as she tore open the envelope. Inside was a small black device made with mil-spec hardware. The Fang. the machine Zig used when he first scanned Nola's fingerprints. "You mind grabbing it for me?" Wags had asked yesterday, when she heard that an FBI colleague was headed to Dover for an errand. "Something wrong with its scanners?" he'd asked. "Just needs a tune-up," she'd lied. It was a Hail Mary for sure, but every day Wags pulled biometrics from terrorist weapons and explosive devices. That was her specialty, what people leave behind. Standing at her desk, Wags spread cyanoacrylate, liquid superglue, across the smoothest part of the scanner. It attached quickly to whatever moisture residue was there. A UV pen light did the rest, revealing the one thing she was hoping for and making her feel like Sherlock Holmes with her very own magnifying glass. A fingerprint. Two of them, actually. 10 minutes later, Wags was staring at her screen, waiting on the FBI's database. Somewhere, servers whirred. Two pictures popped on screen. The first, as expected, was Zig. But the second... Wags swallowed hard. No, that's... can't be. But it was. Wags whispered his name, barely hearing her own words. Horatio's... oh, shit.
78. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. Dino always started with the plain M&Ms. Those were his favorites. He was a purist, preferring the plain ones to peanut, and of course to those abominations with peanut butter or dark chocolate, or that blue-wrappered disaster, the pretzel M&M. No, plain were the best, which explained why Dino always restocked them first in the candy machine. In the moneymaker slot, third row from the top, eye level, center position. From there, he added his full murderer's row of candy. Snickers, Reese's, Crunch Bars, Twix, 100 Grand Bars, Heath Bars, Original Skittles, Sour Skittles, the ultra-underrated Take 5 Bar, and in the very last slot on the right, white chocolate Kit Kats. Because why have the same candy machine as everyone else? Dropping the last pack of plain M&Ms into place, Dino glanced around the break room. This early in the morning, Dover's mortuary was quiet. It wouldn't be for long. One by one, he restocked each row, tilting each chocolate bar backward, just right. If the candy leaned forward, it'd get caught in the coil, stuck in the machine. On a military base, with the tempers here, that was never good for anyone. Kneeling down to work the bottom row, he added extra granola and protein bars, the colonel's favorites, humming a song to himself. Shares, if I could turn back time. How the hell'd that get stuck in his head? With a slam and the twist of a key, Dino shut the front of the machine and, as always, gave it a test. C5. Plain M&Ms. The coil began to spin, the plastic kicker at the end of it giving the bag of M&Ms its final shove. Tunk! Reaching into the vending machine, Dino pulled out the M&Ms. It was still early, but come on. This was the best perk of being the candy man. Actually, second best. Dino tossed back a few M&Ms, shoved the rest in his pocket, then quickly restocked the boxes onto his hand truck. That was the job, every day, putting back what others took. Heading out into the hallway, Dino opted for the long way around, toward the executive offices of the mortuary, home of carpet walkers like accounting and human resources, who never saw bodies, but also where both Zig's and Master Guns's offices were. Zig had already snuck onto the plane. Dino was sure of that. As for Master Guns, the light was on in his office, though based on the open door, Master Guns wasn't there. In the corner, Colonel Sue's light was on as well. Her door was shut. This early in the day? She and Master Guns were both inside. Dino made a mental note. By now, back at the bowling alley, at the Kingpin Cafe, the first pot of coffee should finally be done brewing. Throwing back a few more M&Ms and still humming If I Could Turn Back Time, Dino wheeled the hand truck through the office, toward the front door.
The few secretaries he passed didn't even bother looking up. That's how it was. Every day. No one looked twice at the Candyman.
79. First, Wags called Zig. No answer. She called him again. Same. Straight to voicemail. Didn't even ring. Like his phone was off. Then Wags called Master Guns. Same. No answer. She called again. Still no answer, but it rang 3 times. He wasn't picking up. She sent Master Guns a text. You there? No response. And then, those 3 gray dots appeared, the ellipses that told her Master Guns was writing back. In a meeting. All okay? Master Guns texted. No, emergency. Call me, she texted back. Can't, with Colonel and seek service. Base going on lockdown. You safe? Wags stood there at her adjustable height desk, debating whether to text the words. She had no choice. I know who Horatio is, she hit send. The 3 gray dots came up immediately, then disappeared as her phone rang, vibrating in her hand.
You're on speaker, Master Guns announced as she picked up. I have Colonel Sue and Agent Terry O'Hara from the U.S. Secret Service. You were saying about Horatio?
I know who he is, Wags insisted. I found fingerprints on the fang.
That doesn't mean...
I looked through Dover's entrance records, checking to see when he swiped into the building. He's there every time Zig is, leaves every time Zig leaves. He's been watching all along, she added, pulling up an image on her phone and hitting send. There was a pause and a buzz as the image popped up on Master Guns's phone screen. That's him! That's Horatio! Wags said, still staring at the employee photo of the one man who had access to every building at Dover. The one man who knew everything Zig was up to. Dino.
80. At Dover, most buildings had names. The military is tidy. It prefers names. So, officially, the mortuary was known as the Charles C. Carson Center for Mortuary Affairs. The military museum where Dover stored dozens of old classic airplanes was called the Air Mobility Command Museum. But the building Dino was currently headed to, as he carried a large cardboard box with a Snickers logo on it, Building 1303. That's what it was called on Dover's official maps. But to those who worked on base, it had another name. The Graveyard. A bit melodramatic, to be sure. But as Dino readjusted the Snickers box and eyed the security force's black SUV in the distance, even Dino had to admit, it was an apt name. Back in 1978, during the Jonestown Massacre, preacher Jim Jones asked his followers to drink cyanide-laced grape punch, killing over 900 people, including over 200 children. Since Dover specializes in mass fatalities, 913 corpses were sent here. But with a number that large, the only way to store the bodies was to convert an old 1960s-era metallic warehouse into a massive morgue. Building 1303. Anybody home? Dino called out toward the warehouse's broken windows, which were boarded up. He didn't like coming here. No one liked coming here. Not since those 900 Jonestown corpses were covered in white sheets and spread out across the warehouse's concrete floor. When it happened, the then colonel at Dover said to give it time, that people would eventually forget and the building could be put back into regular use. It almost worked, until a decade ago, when a C-5 Galaxy, the military's largest plane at the time, over 6 stories high, took off from a runway at Dover and mysteriously crashed right after it flew over this exact spot. No one on the plane was killed. Voodoo, everyone called it, blaming it once again on Building 1303. One of the few places at Dover that people actively avoided. Hello? Anyone? Dino called out again, crossing around to the side of the warehouse and checking one last time over his shoulder. The military SUV was long gone. This far south on the base, there were only long, barren cornfields on one side of the building and a scattering of parked airplanes on the other. Using his chest to pin the cardboard box to the wall, Dino reached for the rusted old doorknob and gave it a tug. He knew it'd be open. He unlocked it days ago. "Delivery!" Dino called out, stepping inside and ignoring the metallic whiff of wet coins and rusted old pipes. It was dark inside. They shut off the electricity years ago, the only light coming from a boarded-up skylight that wasn't boarded up as well as it should be. "Back here," a man's voice called out. Dino glanced to his left, where stack after stack of 1950s-era gurneys, at least 2,000 of them, were piled one on top of another, each stack 10 feet high, forming makeshift walls and an instant maze that Dino followed deeper into the wide warehouse. After 9/11, when the Iraq invasion began, the government was keenly aware that every new war brings a massive increase in dead young soldiers. To handle the demand, Dover got $30 million for a new mortuary, filled with $10 million in state-of-the-art equipment. But as all the new items arrived, everything from the old mortuary, which dated back to Vietnam and Korea, had to be thrown away, or at least stored somewhere no one would notice. "You're late," the man's voice called out. "I'm doing my best," Dino replied. He meant it. His entire life, Dino worked hard, but somehow, it was never good enough. In high school, he barely passed. In community college, he scraped by. As a valet, an ice cream store manager, a piercing pagoda employee, even a health club trainer, he struggled, struggled, and struggled. Even now, as he tried to pick up his pace, it led to more stumbling. Dino was a big guy, with a big gut, who lumbered when he walked. "Wait, that's not... Where'd you go?" Dino called out, hitting a dead end down an aisle of 30-foot-high metallic racks that flanked him on both sides. Back during Vietnam, these casket racks held all the new caskets, 6,000 at a time, when the war was at its peak. Now they were filled with old desk chairs, lamps, and leftover office furniture. "Did I tell you this place was something?" Dino shouted, double backing down a different aisle, still trying to navigate the stacks of old metal desks, battered embalming tables, vintage casket carriages, 50-gallon drums of formaldehyde, as well as metal storage racks filled with scalpels, forceps, draining tubes, separators. Every mortician's tool you can think of, all smelling like mildew and decay, all covered in rotten rust, like an entire 1960s funeral home was dumped into a warehouse and forgotten. "By the way, you were right about Zig," Dino called out, his arms holding tight to his cardboard box. "According to the entry records, he came in first thing this morning, driving a hearse. That means Nola was probably in back, huh?" No answer. "You hear what I said?" Dino added, cutting around a huge wooden crate marked, "Warning, carcinogens" in bright red letters. The crate was filled with glass bottles of embalming fluid. "That means Nola..." "What's in the box?" a deep voice interrupted. Dino spun toward a man with buzzed gray hair, a pitted face, and a faded scar that split his bottom lip in a pale zigzag from where it was torn open years ago. Dressed in tan and green camouflage, an army combat uniform, the man stood there, arms behind his back, his greedy eyes taking Dino apart. "Jesus on a pogo stick! Don't do that!" Dino blurted. "I hate scary movies." "The box. What's in it?" the man asked. Dino hesitated, but not for long. "It's for my payment. You said you'd..." "I know what I said." From behind his back, the man pulled out a manila envelope, thick with cash. "If it makes you feel better, you did the right thing." Dino grabbed the money, then turned away, studying the envelope and avoiding eye contact. He took no joy in what he'd done. But at this point, he didn't have a choice. Not with all the debt he was buried under. It started 6 months ago, when his old manager from Piercing Pagoda told him about an opportunity to get in on the ground floor. A brand new PVC piping company. With the filament it used, you could make it yourself on a 3D printer. Miraculous, everyone called it. A game changer. Dino looked it up. It all checked out. Together, they could buy the distributorship for the entire East Coast. This was Dino's chance. His chance to get away from the candy machines, to get out of the bowling alley. His chance to step out of Zig's shadow and finally build something for himself. Something that Zig didn't help him with. All he had to do was pull together the cash. His savings, second mortgage, plus the $20,000 he borrowed from his bookie. Sure, it was a risk. But what great reward came without risk? This was Dino's chance. Unfortunately, it was also a scam, one that took Dino for nearly $250,000. For months, he thought he could dig out. Then Dino's car got repossessed. He told Zig it was in the shop. Then the bookie sent a guy who wore a gold razor blade around his neck. A few times Dino was tempted to ask Zig for help. But God Almighty, he'd spent his whole life asking Zig for help. Eventually, the banks stopped calling and instead started knocking on his door. They threatened to take his house, his wages. They even started going after the joint account his grandmother asked him to co-sign so Dino could help pay her rent and bills. She was 93. If they took that account, Grandma Ruth would be out on the street. So when a man approached Dino, offering to pay Dino's debts, Dino knew there had to be a catch. And there was. All Dino had to do was tell the man where Zig was going and what he was up to. "Are you out of your mind?" Dino replied. No way. He'd never screw over his friend. That is, until the man explained that he didn't want to hurt Zig either. He just wanted information. Where Zig was on base. Who he was talking to. If anything, considering the people Zig was investigating, it would save Zig's life. More important, the man explained, if Dino wouldn't help, he'd find someone else who would. It was that last point that Dino couldn't argue with. At least this way, Dino could keep an eye on everything, managing the situation and keeping Zig safe. Did Dino feel bad that day when he knocked Zig in the head? Of course. He felt awful. But at that point, to grab Camille's items from the room and to make sure Zig didn't spot him, Dino had no choice. Keeping Zig in the dark meant keeping Zig safe. Plus, with the influx of cash, Dino could pay off his debts, keep his car and house, and pay for Grandma Ruth. All of his financial problems would disappear. Like magic. You hear what I said about Zig in the hearse? Dino asked, staring down as he clutched the envelope of money, tempted to open it. Somehow, though, it felt rude. I'm telling you, Nola's on that plane to Alaska. No, the man said quietly. She isn't. There was something in the man's voice. Something that made Dino want to turn around. He didn't, though. How do you know? Those would be the final words Dino ever uttered. Behind him, Dino didn't see the man pull out his gun, didn't hear as the man cocked a bullet into the chamber. Dino was too busy dropping the envelope into his cardboard Snickers box, congratulating himself for picking such a good hiding place. Dino, the man said. Following the sound, Dino glanced over his shoulder. The gun was already at Dino's temple, the angle just right, so when they later found the gun, along with a pile of collection notices, even the best investigators would be convinced it was a suicide. A jagged black hole appeared in Dino's temple, burn marks scorching his skin. His head whipped sideways, chasing the bullet, followed by his torso, then his body, all his weight dragged to the side like a toppling tree. Thud. As Dino hit the concrete floor, a single spurt of blood gushed like a tiny waterfall down his temple, across the side of his nose, then another. That was it. For a moment, The man with the pale zigzag scar stood there. He wasn't looking at Dina. He was staring straight ahead, out into the warehouse. "I know you're here," he called. No one replied. "You think I'm a fool?" the man added. "You followed Dino here, didn't you, Nola?" There was a noise on his left, a click, like a gun being cocked. From behind a tall stack of 1950s metal desks, Nola just stood there, her gun pointed at the man. "Horatio, huh?" Nola asked. "That's what you're calling yourself now?" The man laughed, a soulful, hearty laugh that came from deep in his belly. The man who knew IDs better than anyone. "Don't be so formal, Nola." "I know it's been a while," Royal said, flashing his wolfish grin. "But you can still call me Dad."